Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. The hero of Catherine Ma's new novel, The Chinese Groove, is a young man who arrives in San Francisco from the Yunnan province in China. He has little money, few connections, but he does have a love for language, those little phrases that can captivate us in a second language, the idioms and idiosyncrasies of how people talk before it all just melts back into communication. Umbrage, bric-a-brac, humors, crapmobile, bushwhacked. Shelley, as he becomes known, is a delightful narrator of an extremely San Francisco story of immigration, housing insecurity, and chosen family. Ma joins us to talk about the outer sunset and optimism after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Catherine Ma lived a whole other life before she became a writer, a master's in history from Stanford, a JD from Berkeley's law school. But now she's got three books to her name, the celebrated novel The Year She Left Us, a short story collection, All That Work and Still No Boys, and this new novel, The Chinese Groove, set here in San Francisco where she's lived for 30 years. It's rambunctious and fun, defamiliarizing the city and its multicultural residents through the eyes of someone who wants to see the best in this place and is not always disappointed. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Catherine.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So why don't we meet this character, Shelley, in whom optimism springs eternal against sometimes the preponderance of the evidence. Some reviewers have called him, you know, naive or deluded, but I feel like he knows what's going on and just chooses his delusions.
Shelley is a natural-born optimist. I don't think we see that many of those kinds of characters in fiction. And I wanted to introduce a character who was just by nature buoyantly happy. But he also is happy and super self-confident, I think, because he has to be. He has to be a survivor. He was born into what he calls the despised branch of his family back in Yunnan, China. And there's no one in his corner. His father loves him, is close to him, but his father is thwarted by his own grief. Shelley's mother has died when Shelley was a young lad, and his father is mired in that in the past and unable to move on. So Shelley has to be his own champion, and that's how he moves through life, with great buoyancy, with optimism. It gets him into all sorts of trouble, but it also gives him the resiliency he needs to forge a new path.
Yeah. Let's set up the passage that you're going to read, which is sort of, he's arrived in San Francisco in this wonderful place, and he is taking his first voyage into this new wonderland. And where's he going, and what's happening?
Shelley is 18 years old. He and his father have decided that Shelley should finally fulfill his mother's dream for him, which is to leave China, come to America. He has some distant relatives. He calls them Uncle Ted and Aunt Aviva. They're actually distant cousins, and they live in the Outer Sunset District, and he's imposing himself on them. He's trying to worm his way into their lives. They want nothing to do with this young man, but there he is. He's been picked up at the airport by Uncle Ted. We got in Uncle's car, the crapmobile, he called it, though to me it was very nice having four wheels and two axles, and drove to a store so monumental that Good Joe's half million could have supplied themselves for a year. I realized he'd been making a dry-witted joke about all the stuff being gone in Costco, and I put myself on alert to Uncle's humors. For the next 30 minutes, I scouted the rows and sniffed the air like a hunter, tasting inside my nostrils the perfumes and garden scents of cleansers and refresheners and an elegant scalloped box of something called vaginal tablets. I ate well, too, out of little paper cups handed to me by smiling ladies. After 2 dozen, I was ready for a meal. Down the aisle, I saw Uncle looking relieved as he crossed off the last item on a list from Auntie Aviva, written in purple ink and dotted with exclamations. He signaled me, and we bushwhacked to the exit. I admit to you now that I was feeling nervous. Uncle, being family, was bound by the rules, the Chinese groove, to play host, even to me, the renegade's weevil. But his wife might resent the fact that I'd stuck my flag on their map. I wished that I knew more about her, since the mistress of the house could make things go roughly or smoothly. The real source of my worry? She wasn't Chinese. She was white. The relatives called that American.
That was Catherine Ma reading from her novel, The Chinese Groove, one of the opening scenes set at a Costco. You know, one of the things that I really loved about this book, and I love the way that it moved, is when you're learning another language, you pick up these little idioms, these like kind of sayings and ways of talking. And this book really is kind of about the poetry of language learning. Like, as the narrator really has this natural poetry in the way that he writes, but it's built out of this collage of Americanisms and Britishisms that he's picked up in his language learning.
Yes, Shelley has been learning English in China. He has a language teacher. His mother has this dream for him that she wants him to be able to learn English because she thinks that that's going to be his ticket to economic opportunity when he grows up. So he does learn English from a woman who's British-born, whom he calls Miss Chips, in his hometown of Guizhou in Yunnan province. And Miss Chips' father was a linguist, and Miss Chips loves language, and she passes some of that on to her pupil. And it was so fun to write Shelley, because he does love language, and he loves wordplay. He makes up all sorts of funny phrasing of his own. He makes up the phrase, the Chinese groove. And his voice came to me very easily. Mm. But I had to rein him in. Sometimes he ran away with me a little bit. when I was working on this book, because I was writing about the Outer Sunset, I often worked at the library at UCSF on the Parnassus campus. The public was at that time allowed to work in the Kalmanowitz Library. And I would go in there every day with my little sandwich and my laptop. And one day, a med student who was in his scrubs came over to my carrel and rapped on the edge of it and frowned down at me. And he said, "Will you stop talking out loud to yourself?" And he was so annoyed with me. And I realized, oh, I was sitting in there doing all the funny voices. It was very embarrassing.
Oh,
but
my gosh.
I didn't blame him for being annoyed. But that was Shelley. He inhabited me from the get-go, from the very earliest attempts I made at starting this novel. I had the voice, and it was a great pleasure to write.
And I love him, too, performing, too, right? He's performing through this whole book, and it really reminded me of an interview I once did with a Filipino sailor, you know, who'd been a cook on a ship for years and years, away from his family 9 months at a time. And, you know, I asked him where he was from, and he's been very quiet through the whole time, and he said, "I'm from the Philippines. The Pearl of the Orient," you know, and it was like he'd memorized this little phrase to say, and it was truly amazing. And I know, you know, in Spanish, which I've been trying to relearn, that I have those little tidbits that are so satisfying when you get them down and you know how to deploy them. Let's talk a little bit about this concept of the Chinese groove. What does it mean to Shelley to be in the Chinese groove?
Shelley has this belief that there is a deep connection that runs between countrymen. He calls other Chinese in the diaspora his countrymen. And it's both a hope for him and a hazard. The hope is he's leaving his home, he's leaving his family, and he's going out into the unknown. And he thinks he has a safety net. He thinks it's okay because other people, my countrymen, will look out for me. And I don't even need to really speak my fears or speak my desires. We will be able to communicate with each other at some deep level. It's a belief in these deep cultural and ancestral bonds. But it's a hazard for him because he is relying on it to fill in the gaps for him, to make up for the fact that he has no prospects, he has no job, he has no housing. He's hoping that people are going to lend him a hand. And sometimes that works out for him, but sometimes it doesn't. And what part of his journey is that he has to learn how to communicate for himself. And communication and the ways in which it fails us and the ways in which we learn to make ourselves vulnerable to one another and speak to one another, that's a major theme of the book.
We're talking with Catherine Ma about her new novel, The Chinese Groove. She's going to be at Book Passage in Corte Madera on February 5th in conversation with Vanessa Waugh. We want to hear from you. Does your culture have a groove, these kind of unspoken and complex understandings between people that you hope you get right? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. We want to know, does your culture have this kind of groove? Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, we're KQED Forum, and the email is forum@kqed.org. I mean, one of the things that struck me about the concept of the Chinese groove, though, was a little bit like, I know that you know that I know that you know, and so therefore we can say nothing, right? and there is, you know, you say one of the themes is learning to speak out loud, but it also feels like one of the themes is like learning other people's grooves, learning what can remain unspoken.
Yes, you describe it perfectly, particularly when it comes to families. I think it's so ironic to me that within our family, that may be the place where communication often fails us. Mm. And family members bring so much expectation and need to the conversation between each other amongst themselves that sometimes, and it can be painful for family members to speak. In the book, both sets of families, the family in China and the family in San Francisco, are working their way through grief. And so to talk about their feelings, to really understand where each other is coming from, how they're processing events which have traumatized them, is a very painful exercise for them. So exactly, they think, I don't have to talk to you. I could just be in the room with you, and you must understand how I'm feeling. And as we find out along the way, that doesn't always work for these families. They very much have a river of sadness running through their lives that they need to learn how to navigate.
And that's made a little bit more complex, but also aided at times by all the kind of chosen family arrangements that are here. I mean, you've got this distant second cousin, but you've also got another couple that loses their housing and ends up arriving also at the doorstep of Ted and Aviva, the San Francisco couple. And they've all got to try to navigate the various ways in which they kind of what they can talk about and what is remaining silent.
Yeah, another part of the book is how we choose our communities, how we create communities. There's the family unit, and of course there's a major question about how you individuate from a family, how do you stake your own territory with a family, and there's also the intentional communities that we create. And Shelley heads out for America convinced that he's going to find a better family than the one he left behind, and he has to learn how to create those bonds.
We're talking with Catherine Ma about her new novel, The Chinese Groove, out now. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more right after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with the novelist Catherine Ma about her new book, The Chinese Groove. And I want to hear from you. Does your culture have a groove, this kind of complex, unspoken understanding, or at least hope for understanding, between the people of your culture? You could give us a call, give us an example. We also wonder, you know, if you're an immigrant to the U.S., what were your expectations and experiences of your, you know, people from the same country of origin, your countrymen, countrywomen, helping you out? The number's 866-733-6786. That does happen in this book. Shelley does get some help from various people. The number again is 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, we're KQED Forum, and the email is forum@kqed.org. I want to talk a little bit about one of the stories that's kind of embedded in inside this book, which is the kind of migration story of people who first came to Chinatown and then left for other points in the city, in this case, the Outer Sunset.
Yes, I consider migration in a couple of different ways in the book. Of course, we have Shelley's migration from Yunnan province to the United States. But there's another kind of migration that really interests me, and that's the movement of people within their own community. So when Shelley comes to live with his relatives, a part of that family that's now in the U.S. or already in the U.S. Has essentially migrated from San Francisco's Chinatown to the Outer Sunset. And this is a journey that in some ways can be as daunting and complex as a transnational journey. This Outer Sunset District in the mid-20th century was an area that where working-class families, middle-class families could find housing. At first, they were kept out by restrictive covenants when that housing was first built in the 20s, 30s, 40s. But eventually, the laws changed. First at California state level, then in the federal laws changed, and these restrictive covenants that said no Jews, no Chinese, no blacks, you know, various communities of color were kept out. Those were stricken from the books, and families like the relatives Shelley has, families were permitted to move there. And Shelley is learning about all those things as he comes to the Outer Sunset. He's disappointed when he gets there. I mean, after all, the Outer Sunset District is the brunt of a lot of jokes in San Francisco. But it has a very special place in my heart because when I was born, my parents lived in Levittown and in Pennsylvania. And to me, the Outer Sunset has that same feel of uniform housing, cheaply built, and opportunity for families, working-class families, middle-class families, to actually get a foothold in America.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. What is your sunset kind of look like? What's your outer sunset look like? If you were to kind of draw your map, like, where are the points that are on there where you were like, okay, I'm in the outer sunset, and this is the thing I love about it?
Well, importantly, oh, you mean now, currently, or you mean in the...
Yeah, kind of, or back then, yeah. But I was thinking
yeah.
now.
Yeah, well, I guess I'll start with the book, because there is a very important location in the outer sunset to this book, which is that... Ted's mother's family had been raised in Chinatown, and they leave Chinatown and they open a small convenience store at the corner of 46th and Noriega, and that was an important location for me. I spent a lot of time just hanging out on that corner. Okay, I admit it. I would have a slice of pizza every now and then. Pizza,
but I think that's okay.
that is a place of that was in its way a kind of utopia for this family. Okay, we've now moved up. We're moving up the economic ladder, and we've made it to the Outer Sunset, and we're buying a house on a different avenue nearby, and we're putting down roots. We're going to make our own economic opportunities. And I love the Outer Sunset. I like, of course, you know, for me, just being out on the beach and the great beach and being able to take, well, I mean, what a miracle that we live in this city where we have beach so close by. But for me, it's also the many communities that reside side by side in the Outer Sunset. And that's reflected in the small businesses and the neighborhood establishments that permeate that neighborhood. That's mm-hmm. where the real heart of the feeling is, I think, my feeling for the Outer Sunset. It's in all the migrant communities, the small businesses, the feel of the neighborhood as you walk block to block. When Shelley first gets there, he's sort of like, wait, I thought my American relatives were really rich. He thought they owned a huge department store on the best corner in San Francisco. They were going to set him up with a job and housing. And he's dismayed to find out they live rather modestly in the foggy avenues. But eventually he comes to understand the beauty of the place and the beauty of the home and community that's created there.
Of course, the irony is that owning two houses in one family in the Outer Sunset basically does make you globally top 1% wealth in the world, right?
He can't fathom that. And can we? I mean, it's nuts.
Right.
It's
right.
nuts.
Right.
You know, the family that where he lives, that he's inherited, his Uncle Ted and Aunt Aviva, they say we cannot afford to leave. Ted is very unhappy. He associates the home with a trauma that he and his wife have experienced. But he said, we can't afford to leave this small house. He calls it their salt box in the Outer Sunset. And the logic of the housing market is turned upside down. And that's one of the things the book looks at. It looks at affordable housing, mm-hmm. and it asks, what is housing? What is a home? What does it mean to have a home and to have a roof over your head? And Shelley bounces from place to place to place after his relatives deny him housing until he finally figures out how to make it work for him.
Yeah. You know, there is, I don't want to give away too much of the plot of the book, but there's an act of gun violence in the book that's very central to what comes later. And I've been wondering, you know, we've had two major incidents here in California related to Chinese Americans of different communities, Monterey Park and in Half Moon Bay. Just having considered this for this book and been kind of immersed in the holes that gun violence can make in communities and in families, how are you doing on this?
Thank you for asking that. I'm shaken by the violence, as are all Californians, I think, and throughout the country. Here are two peaceful communities already under prolonged stress from economic hardship and anti-immigrant sentiment, and they are now experiencing the aftermath of horrific violence. So my heart goes out to the people who are living through those terrible events. I can't speak for them, but what I am doing is learning a little bit about them. And it's very moving to me to learn about this large group of older age ballroom dancers in Monterey Park, and to learn more about the Latino and Asian farm workers in Half Moon Bay. Many of them were also older in age. I've checked myself. I mean, they were there. They've always been there. But now we're seeing them more fully. And I think the job of the novelist is to make one's characters seen more fully, to make them visible to the reader. Maybe that what is seen more fully is better understood, and maybe through the novel we have a way to deepen our humanity toward one another. And this novel, The Chinese Groove, it's a celebration of the different ways in which we create community. You referred to that earlier, Alexis. Intentional community is part of the book. And in times like these, I think we do help each other. We build resilience by helping each other.
Yeah. I mean, one of the delightful things about the book, too, is seeing a kind of background level of human diversity that we almost take for granted in the Bay Area. You know, seen through the eyes of someone who's coming from a place where, you know, most people have a very similar cultural background, have been there for quite some time in many cases. And Shelley arrives in San Francisco and goes, oh, my God, look at all these different types of people.
Yeah, his mind is a whirl. He can't believe when they leave Costco and they come home, and he immediately walks into a New Year's party, and he can't believe the mixtures of people and the mixed marriages, which he really finds confounding. Different people of different races, different ethnicities married to one another, and what he calls that party pack of kids.
Mm-hmm. Confounding, but also hopeful, because he has a love interest who's a white woman.
True, true. He does. And hopeful because his father has told him that America is a kind of utopia, that a people of all different races and backgrounds live together in perfect harmony. There's a fable that runs throughout the book, which is called The Legend of the Peach Blossom Forest, which is a very famous, an old ancient legend in Chinese folklore. And Shelley and his father think of San Francisco as the ultimate peach blossom forest, a utopia, a Shangri-La, and, you know, a kind of perfect, harmonious community. And Shelley comes with that expectation, but he also finds out it's not exactly true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's bring in our first caller here. Let's bring in Stephen in Mill Valley to talk about his particular groove. Welcome, Stephen.
Oh, thank you, Alexis. And thank you to the author. Very inspiring to me as a burgeoning young author of, in the 70s. my culture is I come from New Jersey, the Gold Coast of the East Coast. I just made that up after listening to you. I've been out here in California for almost 40 years, but there's still a lot of aspects of my culture that I bring. My father was Jewish and my mother was Irish. And so I don't really have a particular culture other than my New Jersey culture. Mm. And the people I've met out here from New Jersey, it's interesting. I just want to say this one more thing. When I meet people from Pennsylvania, they say, I'm from Pennsylvania. I have a good close friend from Pennsylvania. People from Connecticut say, oh, I'm from Connecticut. Or from New York, yeah, I grew up in New York. People from New Jersey say, yeah, I'm from the East Coast. So it's difficult to admit you're a Jerseyan.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've adapted to the San Francisco culture, which I was reading about before I came out here and been entranced in, you know, the hate and so on. But mm-hmm. my culture really, I guess, is the counterculture. And that's mm-hmm. who I identify with still. People who are looking to bring about change.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, that's beautiful, Stephen. I appreciate that. Two different grooves, really. You're also making me think about when I went on my first time I was ever in New Jersey. I walked into a sandwich shop to get a sandwich with my dad. First moment, and I said hello. And when the person started talking, I had absolutely no idea what they were saying to me. I was like, that is an accent I have never heard, never having left the West Coast, pretty much. Took me a while to adjust to East Coast accents, for sure, and the speed and pace and all the other parts of that group. Catherine Mott, do you yourself identify with the sort of countercultural elements of San Francisco? Like, is that part of the draw for you, or is that actually another kind of city within a city of San Francisco that you can appreciate but don't necessarily see yourself as a part of?
I love San Francisco. And San Francisco is a kind of character on its own in this book. And I think I am drawn to the multicultural aspects of our community. But at the same time, I see the ways in which we are somewhat confounded by being people of so many different backgrounds and interests and political opinions, and how do we live harmoniously. Mm-hmm. I love your comment, Steve. I think you have a lot of Shelley in you, Steve. I mean, first of all, that you would call New Jersey the Gold Coast. I mean, I'm just in love with that because Shelley loves where he comes from. He's very proud of being Chinese. He has not left China because he's ashamed of his roots. In fact, he trumpets his roots to anybody who will listen, but he also understands that economic opportunity lies elsewhere. But you're absolutely right, Steve, that the Chinese groove exists in every culture, I think, in every aspect of our life. Sometimes it's geographic. Sometimes it has to do with our region. And there are all sorts of different ways we create identities for ourselves. And that's one of the things the book tries to interrogate. I think it's very confusing to have multiple identities. Mm-hmm. I am married to a white Jewish man. My children are both Jewish and Quaker. I was raised Quaker. They are Chinese. They are multiracial. It sounds so easy, but it's actually not so easy to have multiple identities.
How does it sit for them to have these multiple identities and have, you know, grown up in the Bay Area? Do you think that's that sat easily for them, or were you do you imagine they've had a different set of kind of identity questions?
My sense as a parent is that it has sat more easily for them than for me. But I know if I just leave it there, I'll get into trouble at home.
You'll get a text message a little bit later.
Yeah, good thing I turned off my phone. I don't want to speak for them. And the reason I say that is I do think there's been a generational shift. For my parents were immigrants from China. They came in the 40s, both Chinese. And, you know, I was born into that family. The later generation, particularly in my extended family, we've married every which way. And so it's more visible. We were talking earlier about making populations more visible. It's more common. It's more visible. And I'm interested in the ways that we both accept it, but also perhaps struggle with it somehow. I come from a really large extended family. We have big family reunions every 4 years that, you know, 200 people show up. And you talk about party pack of kids. This family covers the gambit. In fact, there was an NPR story done on one of our family reunions a number of years ago, and the title was The Dynasty of Diversity, which has become a hilarious joke in my family, I'm sorry to say, because we feel that it both describes us and maybe overstates the case a little bit for this sort of, modern-day picture of the perfect multicultural family. Yeah. Families are a tricky subject, and they're endlessly fascinating to the novelist.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we've had a lot of, younger millennial and Gen Z novelists on talking about various identity things. How did you think about transmitting, you know, your particular version? I mean, your family is originally from the Yunnan province, just like the characters in this book, although different hometowns, I understand. How did you see, did you feel like they had to know the language, they had to know the place, they had to, or not?
I find that in understanding one's history, it really helps me as a novelist. It may not be evident that the history is all there, but it does. It informs everything I do. And, you know, there are various points of origin for this book. And one of those points was a trip that I took with my parents to my father's hometown in Yunnan province in 1999. It was the first time that my father had been permitted, really, to return to his hometown because his family lived very close to the border of North Vietnam. And even after China reopened to the West, my dad wasn't able to visit his hometown for some years. But I went with him on that trip. And it was a profound trip for us because by the time my dad was able to return home, his parents and all his siblings had perished. Wow. But here we were with all of the relatives, the cousins, and we were seated at a sort of table of honor. My parents were seated at a table of honor, and there was an older gentleman sitting next to my father who clearly was part of the family, but no one was speaking to him. Huh. No one would talk to him, and I didn't understand why he would be there both within the family and without.
Oh, interesting. One of the germs of this, the seeds of this novel. We're talking with Catherine Ma about her new novel, The Chinese Groove. Stay with us. We'll be back right after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're joined this morning by Catherine Ma. We're talking about her new novel, The Chinese Groove, set in San Francisco in kind of the 2010s, right, Catherine?
In 2015. The book is set in 2015.
Yes. We would love to hear from you. Does your culture have a groove, you know, which we've been talking about this morning, these kind of understandings that people can have who are from the same place, or maybe misunderstandings at times? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. We also, you know, this is a great novel about the Outer Sunset and the people who live there. I would love to know if you're from the Outer Sunset or you know it, like, how have you seen your neighborhood represented? Have you seen it represented before? And what's special about it to you? The number is 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, we're KQED Forum. And the email is forum@kqed.org. Catherine, I wanted to talk a little bit about your path to becoming a novelist, but also, you know, kind of the way you grew up, because you actually spent some time in one of the lesser-known Leavitt towns, right? Talk to us a little bit about, you know, growing up in, you know, kind of the defining, one of the defining American suburban experiences.
Yes, I'm totally a suburban child. I don't wear that quite as proudly as I wear my San Francisco identity, but it is true. It's completely informed who I am. My parents, as I said, emigrated from different areas of China and came first to Ohio. They were graduate students at Ohio State University. That's where they met. And my dad worked as an engineer in the steel industry. So we lived in Pennsylvania. And when they brought me home from the hospital, we were at Levittown, Pennsylvania, and then in various suburbs of Philadelphia. And, you know, when you grow up in that kind of environment, all of the insecurity that my parents faced as young immigrants who came during, who really were forced out of their country by war and revolution, there are certain expectations on the children of those people, I think. I mean, talk about the Chinese groove. I mean, I knew what the expectations of my parents were. They didn't have to say a word. You know, I was my path was to find a very secure way to take care of myself financially and you know, establish myself for my family. So when I began as a working person, I began as a lawyer. And but I was always that kid who loved to read. The novel was my first and greatest love when I was young, and I just kind of wondered, do I have it in me to learn how to write, to learn how to be a fiction writer, to learn how to write a novel, to learn how to do the thing which brought me such great pleasure. Mm. And so eventually I did leave my legal career and start to become a writer. It took me forever. I mean, I am old now. It is not easy to learn how to write. I was very stubborn about it, maybe in a way sort of like Shelley, like, I can do this. I decided not to go to school for it. I think it's because I had so much schooling by that point that I didn't
like,
want to go.
Another degree?
Yeah, exactly. what a waste of money and time. I can do this myself. Well, it turns out it takes a lot of time. I was humbled by the process, to be honest. But now I'm so pleased to bring out this novel, The Chinese Groove, into the world. And I think if my parents were here, they're gone now, perhaps they would be proud of me. They were certainly nervous when I announced I was leaving my legal career to try to write a novel. does anything sound more pie in the sky than that?
Yeah.
But I
just
think
the words every parent wants to hear.
Yeah, exactly. But by that time, I had a life of my own, and I had established myself enough in the world. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think of it this way. The legal career was for my mom and dad, mm-hmm. and the writing is for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky. I'm lucky enough that I'm healthy enough and I've lived long enough to be able to do those two things, you know, in series instead of all at once. It'd be pretty darn hard to be a litigator in a downtown San Francisco law firm and write a novel on the side. That's what my mom wanted me to do. She was like, just write in your spare time. And I was like, you just don't have any spare time when you're going to trial and you're raising three kids and, you know, it just doesn't work that way, Mom.
Yeah.
And eventually she was sympathetic to it. And I think she would be proud of me that I finally brought out this this book that celebrates family, yeah. that tussles with the tussles with the kinds of conflicts that arise in family, but ultimately celebrates families, whether it's the family you're born into or the family you create for yourself.
I have to say, I find it very inspiring, and I'm sure many other people out there in our listening audience who put their novel dreams on the shelf while they raise kids and, you know, put food on the table are thinking, you know, maybe it's time. Maybe it's time for them, listeners, to get the dust those dreams back off. You know, you said you didn't go to school for this, but I have noticed that in your bio, you do talk about being part of a book club called a True to the Mood Book Club for 30 years. And I just have to imagine that whoever was in that book club, which I want to hear about, has had a huge influence on this book.
You are exactly right. I have belonged to this book club. We named ourselves True to the Mood after a line in E.M. Forster's novel, A Passage to India. We have been reading books together for decades. We were so foolish. Nobody thought to write down a list of the books because we didn't know that it was going to go on for so long. But we are good friends. And they are a huge part of the reason that I became a writer. They gave me the confidence to think that I could try to do it. And not by talking to me about writing, but by talking to me about books and reminding me of what great pleasure I took from reading books, but also what there is to learn about life in books. And we meet and we argue and we debate. We spend as much time arguing about the next book that we're going to read as we do discussing the book that we just finished. But we have shared. And the incredible thing is, because we have been meeting for so long and reading together, we have now read hundreds of books in common. And what a gift that is, to have a common library.
No kidding.
I mean, that's really interesting. At this point in our existence, this is our 40th year together, actually. So we've read hundreds of books in common, and it's very fun. As we just finished reading the novel The Silence by Don DeLillo, and we were drawing on all the other books we've read in common that speak to what DeLillo was addressing in that book, the questions he was raising. We have a common inventory, you know, is sort of like walking around with a shared library in your head. My mom was a librarian, and I love libraries. I revere libraries. And in a way, when you're in a book club like that and you've read so many books in common, it's kind of like having a library with you every time you're with those friends, because you can peruse the shelves together in your mind.
My gosh, at what point do you bring your books to the book club?
That book club is not allowed to read my. I don't want to hear what. I have no interest in hearing what the book club really thinks about my writing. It would melt me if they didn't love it. I think they understand via groove that their job is simply to praise. I don't have to articulate to that to them, because I respect them so much as readers I don't want to talk about my own writing with them. I barely want to talk about it with my family or my friends. For me, writing a novel is about all the people I don't know, like reaching readers whom I don't know. Who are the people out there with whom I can connect via words on the page? I mean, as a writer, I just love the idea of reaching out into the universe and our minds meeting someplace. We're not in person. We're not engaging with each other face to face. I think that's why I go to Kalmanovitz Library and work there. I love working in libraries. I put on my headphones. Apparently, I talk to myself in funny voices. But it's because you're in the company of people whose minds are at work. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing more interesting to me and actually very emotional for me to be around people who are deeply engaged with work and with what they love to do.
And there's the smell, of course.
Well, Kalmanovitz is wonderful. Well, back in the day, I don't know how it is since the pandemic, but it was the one library where you were allowed to bring in a cup of coffee And I think they took pity on all those nursing and pharmacy and medical students. And it's a one, and it has an incredible view. You know how there was that Burger King in the Presidio that had an incredible view of the Golden Gate Bridge? Kalmanovitz Library is on the hill at Parnassus and has a beautiful view overlooking Golden Gate Park and the De Young Tower and all of that. I guess that's one thing. We were talking about the outer sunset. Mm-hmm. I need a place. I'd love to hear from a listener. Is there a place in the outer sunset you go for a good view? Mm. The outer sunset is very is pretty flat and, you know, rolls out like a long carpet. Where do you go to get a good
That's
view
a
of
good
the outer
question.
Sunset?
We do have an amazing outer sunset comment from Lauren, who writes in. I've lived in the Outer Sunset since 2008 when I opened Andytown Coffee Roasters at 43rd and Lawton in 2014. My friends thought I was crazy because it was, quote, in the middle of nowhere. When we opened our doors, we saw how the Outer Sunset brings together folks from all walks of life and backgrounds. Our communal table would regularly have folks speaking different languages and sharing stories and meeting neighbors. My husband, who's from Ireland, even met a neighbor who he could speak Gaelic with. On our block alone, we have neighbors from at least a dozen different countries. It's amazing to raise my children amongst so many different cultures. And 9 years after opening our doors, we're still out here, quote, in the middle of nowhere, and we love every second of it. The Outer Sunset welcomes everyone, and I'm so grateful to serve this wonderful neighborhood where I live.
I love that. Thank you so much for that. And thank you for the latest Andytown, which is a wonderful place to fuel up before our walks on the Great Highway. And I think every community, not just San Francisco, I bet you every city out there, every community out there has its outer sunset, has its area that the locals know well, that the locals appreciate, that perhaps is not visible to newcomers to the city, a sort of forgotten quarter of that community. But the people who live there know what it is. They have an affection for it. They build their own communities within it. And those are the places that I think really ground us as people living in the modern age.
Yeah. Let's bring in John, who I believe is born and bred San Francisco and might very well have one of those places. Hey, John.
I am born and bred in the Mission District, but I have a spot in the sunset that you can see the Farallone Islands. It's a hill in the San Francisco Zoo, maybe on the west end of the zoo. It rises about 100 feet, and it's the best view of on a clear day. You know, the Farallones is, what, 26 miles from shore? And they're beautiful on a clear day, you know, when there's no fog, which is rare in the sunset because summertime is, you know, the foggy time of the year.
I also, one of the most amazing things is over the last few days, even from Tilden, but definitely from, you know, some of the parks in the East Bay, you could see all the way to the Sierras. That's how clear it's been. So this is the time to try and get the view that John is talking about. Sir John, were you going to say something else?
What?
Were you going to say something else?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say that, you know, this program, because the first caller you had is writing a book, a young man writing a book. I'm an old man, and I'm writing a book about the Mission District, my childhood, you know, Irish, Irish and Latino. I grew up an Irish-Mexican. Mission High School was one-third Irish, one-third Mexican, and one-third black. And it was a great way to grow up as a kid. You know, no racial problems. All my buddies married Latino girls and had the most beautiful blue-eyed, tan-skinned children in the world. You know?
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
John,
I miss that. I miss it because it's not like that now. You know, it's the techies are in there with all their money and ruining the Mission District, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, John.
Money seems to ruin certain
things. Yeah, John. Thank you so much. I just want to ask, Catherine. I mean, that is a piece of this book, right? The money that has flooded into the San Francisco that John loves, that you love, that many people out there love, and also, you know, this is what has happened in San Francisco time and time again, right? I mean, the city that we loved was built by newcomers time and time again, you know. And I've never really known how to hold those two thoughts together, you know.
It is a great challenge for us, and I think cities are always under pressure and are constantly changing, and it's one of the things that has thrown the American relatives off course. They don't really, they are in a way, of course, they're grappling with personal trauma, but I think they're also grappling with change, and they don't quite know how to react to it. And it complicates the story in a way that will be familiar to readers. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we deal with change? How do we respond to pressure? And there's a political subplot in the book dealing with how a local politician is trying to, in his public life, trying to support immigrant businesses, newcomers, new businesses, and change, but also up to no good. And you know, these things go hand in hand, as you say. There are conflicts present always. There's always that tension, and part of the job of the novelist is to explore some of those tensions, to try to bring them out and ask questions, necessarily answer.
Anna is answering your call for a good view in the outer sunset as well. Anna in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi, good morning. I'm proud of family in the outer sunset. I have two young kids, and we spent a lot of time at our gorgeous Ortega Library. It's a San Francisco public library. It's on Ortega and I believe about 40th Avenue. And not only do you get a gorgeous view of, you know, the ocean and the sunset, but you have the library right there. And there's such a great playground for the kids. Mm. When we're there, we see the view. We get to check out the library. The kids get to play. And it's also a wonderful multicultural spot. There's dancing. The older generation is dancing. The kids are playing. And we just love it. So I encourage you to go visit. And anyone with kids is such a special place to be.
I love that, Anna. That's perfect. Catherine, that's what you wanted, right?
Yes, thank you for that. I have discovered the Sunset Community Center. I think it's near that where Anna just described. A wonderful place. And I want to give a shout out to the Chinese Historical Society of America, our very own museum that preserves the history of the Chinese American in the United States, and in particular in our own community. Mm-hmm. They helped me with this book. They may not know it, but they did a wonderful exhibit right at the time when I was working on the book in the early stages, called "The Chinese in the Sunset," and they talked about this idea, this phenomenon of Chinese migration from Chinatown into different areas of the city. And I went to the exhibit, which was at the Sunset Community Center, and I met a number of people there who lived in the Sunset, and I got to interview people. I got to gather some oral histories for the book, and all of that informed the kind of history I gave my characters.
That's beautiful. Last comment. Jed writes in to say, "I'm an 80-year-old Black American. The deep African-American culture and identity built up since 1619 from ground zero is often acknowledged between strangers with a simple head nod or 'how you doing?' Another kind of groove." We've been talking with Catherine Ma about her novel, The Chinese Groove. You can catch her at Book Passage in Corte Madera on Sunday, February 5th. Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. This is Forum. Stay tuned for another hour ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.